In the news this week, the brewing fight over union rights and collective bargaining erupted in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. On Beacon Hill, a budget proposal to contain soaring local health care costs would strip unions of their right to bargain over parts of their health care plans.
And with new conservative muscle in the state house, New Hampshire took a big step towards becoming the first right-to-work state in New England. Here's GOP New Hampshire State Senator Jim Forsyth.
No, you can't be forced to join the union. That is true. But if you're forced to be represented by the union and you're forced to make contributions, I would ask, what's the difference at that point?
And speaking of New Hampshire, Donald Trump is on his way to the Granite State to test the presidential waters. The star of Celebrity Apprentice wants to fire Barack Obama.
According to a recent poll, Trump is one of the most recognized Republicans who might run for president. Is he serious?
And is he ready to take on Mitt Romney?
Mitt Romney. I don't really know him, but I like him. I sort of like him. The question was, you know, how do you compare? I'm much richer than he is, okay? That doesn't make me better necessarily at all.
Also this week, the case of Judge Raymond Duggan of the Boston Municipal Court. A Boston Globe investigation and Suffolk County District Attorney Dan Connolly make the case that he's soft on criminals.
Judge Duggan has, over about a 20-year period, exhibited a hostility towards law enforcement, and these decisions are adversely affecting public safety in Boston.
Duggan's defenders accuse Connolly of trying to squelch judicial independence. Joining us now to talk about these and other events this week are Julie Mahegan, Deputy Editorial Page Editor of the Boston Herald. Julie, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to see you. And Jeff Jacoby, columnist with the Boston Globe, joins us on the line from the Globe. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, guys. Great to be with you.
Great to have you back after so much time. And listeners, what do you think? What's your take on the news this week? What story caught your attention? You can give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, Julie, Jeff, let's start with this big story about the Boston Municipal Court and Judge Duggan and D.A. Connolly. Just to bring our listeners a little bit up to date who might not have followed it, the Boston Globe published a front page above the fold story that lays out a case that Judge Duggan has a pattern of decisions and leniency that favor defendants. His defenders say Connolly, D.A. Connolly, has overstepped, that this is a troubling assault on judicial independence on part of Connolly. What do you think, Julie? Let me start with you. What caught your attention about this story?
Well, you know, I think it was Chief Justice John Roberts who came up with the famous balls and strikes analogy. Judges are supposed to be umpires, and I think, you know, the story laid out the case, or Dan Connolly's case, that this judge is giving far too many defendants free passes. I think, you know, when I first read the story, I thought to myself, okay, well, is some of this just a matter of judicial discretion, or is Connolly just, you know, bruised feelings here and that kind of thing? But then the more you read it, and as presented, there's clearly, especially I was struck by a concern from the higher courts that have overturned some of his rulings in these individual cases, particularly I think the one with the SJC, which warned him about substituting his personal opinion in at least one criminal case. So, you know, I think Dan Connolly's running a risk here. He's going way, way out on a limb, which I think speaks to his level of frustration with the judge's rulings over the years. Mm.
Jeff Jacoby, chime in here. What's your take on this story?
Dan Connolly isn't a hothead. He doesn't tend to fly off the handle. It's very unusual for a prosecutor to be doing something like this. And if he's willing to do it and be this out in public about it, it suggests that there's something here that deserves to be looked at. And you go through the Globe story and the kinds of cases that were described in there, the numbers, the fact that Duggan's decisions get appealed far more than any other judge in the system, that his decisions get reversed or modified on appeal far more than any other judge. I mean, Julie's right when you talk about the judge's role is primarily supposed to be the umpire calling the balls and strikes. That said, we all know that judges do have a certain amount of leeway. But there's a difference between leeway and going way off the reservation. Mm-hmm. And if all of these allegations and charges and complaints measure up, and that's what the SJC investigation is supposed to look into, it suggests that this is a judge who's taking the idea of judicial independence and judicial discretion way beyond where it's supposed to be.
Well, in response, we should point out a number of prominent defense attorneys are defending Judge Duggan. They point out that Connolly's complaint, and for that matter, the Globe piece, mentioned about 25 decisions out of, I guess, some 50,000 decisions over a 20-year career. And you know, they make the case that this is clearly a case of a DA going after a liberal judge who he just whose opinions he just doesn't like. Let me just play a cut of tape. This was from a report from our own David Boeri, who spoke this week to Judge Duggan's attorney, Michael Keating. Let's listen.
Judge Duggan's been on the bench for 20 years. He's a veteran. He can take the heat, and he will take the heat. But that's not going to necessarily be the case with a lot of judges. A lot of judges don't have his level of experience. And what worries me about this is the message kind of gets out to the judicial community that if you don't play ball with the prosecutors, you can end up above the fold in the Boston Globe. That's the problem here, in my opinion, besides the judicial independence problem.
Julie Mahegan, does Keating have a point at all that's worthy of consideration there?
Well, I do think that the number of cases that were considered here, I think a lot of people would look at and say, okay, over the course of his career, they're talking about a small number of cases that were spelled out in the Globe. Having said that, I almost chuckle because every time we run a story in the Herald that's even remotely critical of a judge, we start getting letters to the editor immediately from defense attorneys who are writing to us and telling us this is the best judge of all time. He's a wonderful jurist. He's above reproach. And so I just have to think about the source in this case and folks who are having to bring their clients before Judge Duggan. Mm. So.
Yeah, really, what would you expect defense attorneys to say when they hear, you know, when the story is about a judge who lets criminal suspects go? You know, I thought that one of the most interesting details in the story was that back in 2009, privately, not going public with it, Dan Connolly had gone to the court system and had said, look, there's this problem with this judge. And the judge was removed from criminal cases for something like 18 months. If the story is reported correctly, and as far as I know, there's no reason to think otherwise, it was only when they put him back on the criminal side that Connolly decided to go public with it. The fact that, if true, the fact that they would take a judge off criminal cases, put him on the civil side for so long, suggests that his superiors understood that this is not just blowing smoke. There's really fire there.
Well, Jeff, as you mentioned, the SJC has appointed an independent attorney to look at this matter. So, you know, it's probably wise for all of us to withhold too much judgment until that investigation is over. Having said that, Jeff, let me ask you this. The timing, the release of this 72-page report from DA Connolly right after this Globe series appears. What do you make of that?
I think he figured he would strike while the iron was hot. I mean, I can't fault him for doing that. And frankly, you know, I mean, yes, the SJC has been asked to order an investigation. It has done so, and we're all going to step back, including Connolly, presumably, and wait to see what that investigation shows. But, you know, it's worth pointing out, the way things work in this state is that a judge has to be extraordinarily off the reservation, totally outrageous, before any kind of discipline ever gets imposed. In Massachusetts, unlike virtually every other state in the union, state judges are appointed for what is essentially a lifetime appointment. It is totally not the norm. In almost every other state, even if governors have the right to appoint a judge, there are periodic retention elections when the voters have at least some opportunity to weigh in. There's a belief in our system that public officials, including judges, ought to be accountable. In Massachusetts, they are virtually unaccountable, which is why these kind of cases are so shocking when they happen.
Jeff, let me just point out, though, I mean, of course, the thinking there is the lifetime appointments is supposed to insulate them from political considerations. But anyway, you make your point well. Let's take a call. We actually have a criminal defense lawyer who's on the line, Chris from Bay Village. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, just calling because I was kind of outraged by the whole debate, just falling in line with Judge Roberts' notion that the judges call things with balls and strikes, I think it's just setting up a straw man first, because I don't think judges do that. For the most part, judges in this Commonwealth are former prosecutors. Appeals court judges are former prosecutors. The fact that Judge Duggan's been here for 20 years and Dan Connolly is coming up with, you know, a few handful of cases, I don't see Dan Connolly questioning judges who have, you know, routinely believe every single cop testimony they ever hear. And they're complaining that Judge Duggan doesn't always believe a police officer. Oh, well, heaven forbid. And where is the Globe's independent analysis of what went on here? We'll just take Dan Connolly's word for it and publish basically his motion. Where is the independent newspaper here?
All right, Chris. Well, thanks for your call. Folks, I think we should move on because we've got a couple of other issues to cover. So let's move on. Let's talk about the fight over collective bargaining and union rights, which has moved from states like Wisconsin and Ohio right here to Massachusetts, sort of. As you both know, House Speaker Robert DeLeo proposing a state budget that would strip local public unions of the right to bargain over some aspect of their health care coverage. The plan would give mayors or town councils authority to set the copays and deductibles for local employees. The unions are saying this is an outright assault on collective bargaining. Julie Mahegan, what do you think?
Well, I think probably one of the more noteworthy things about this is that there's news now that I think there are 50 Democrats that have signed on to an alternative proposal that's backed by organized labor. And I think it's kind of amazing in the state that that's actually news, that there may actually be a debate on this, that the result wasn't preordained. We've given the House Speaker a boatload of credit for his proposal. He's, speaking of going out on a limb, he's gone way out on a limb here and challenged some of the traditional Democratic base of organized labor. And, you know, his support and his backing for this is enormous. I mean, it is the most meaningful proposal or the proposal that will result in the most meaningful savings for cities and towns. And it's not Wisconsin.
Well, as you mentioned, some 50 House Democrats, including some of DeLeo's own committee chairs, are backing a union alternative, an alternative that would require negotiations on any changes. What do you think, Jeff Jacoby? What kind of debate is this going to lead to?
Well, first of all, the union alternative, which is being proposed and being pushed by Martin Walsh, who's not only a state rep from Dorchester, but also a union official, is a complete joke. It would basically strip any kind of reform out of the whole system. It would force local officials to have to go to binding arbitration if they're not able to come to an agreement with the union at the table. Binding arbitration is basically a way of saying some outsider comes in and imposes a contract, imposes the terms on them. I was totally impressed to see Bob DeLeo do this. And if he manages to continue to stand up and show some backbone in the face of the threats from the unions, which are just going to get harsher and harsher as the debate goes forward, I will truly, my respect for him will really just be off the charts. Julie's right. She says this is not Wisconsin. I say more's the pity. This is only a tiny fraction of what was proposed in Wisconsin and an even smaller fraction of what was passed in Ohio. All this does, basically, is enable the municipal officials to move their employees into the state's group insurance commission, and it eliminates the right of collective bargaining over deductibles and copays. That's a tiny, tiny little movement in the direction of reform. The truth of the matter is public employees, government employees, they shouldn't have the right to collective bargaining. There's something that's different about working in the public sector than working in the private sector. There are all kinds of ways to protect, to legitimately protect the interest of government employees. The way to do it is not through the mistake that's gotten worse and worse over recent decades, giving them unionizing rights, which enables them essentially to vote out their bosses. You see them making threats in this story. You know, the union officials telling state reps, "You don't vote with us, we're going to remember it. We're going to come after you. We're going to vote against you. It's going to count against you." You know, I work in a union shop. I belong to a union. The Boston Globe is a unionized organization. But if the union here doesn't like something that happens, we don't have the power to go and vote out the publisher of the Boston Globe. It's very, very different when you're talking about the public sector and the idea that government employees who spend money that's from the taxpayer and whose every action affects public policy should be able to have this kind of extra bite at the apple. I think it's been a mistake all along, and we should be rolling it back.
Well, we'll see. Meanwhile, unions here trying
total heresy in Massachusetts.
It's a little bit of a heretical notion, Jeff, as I'm sure you know. Meanwhile, the unions here trying to flex some muscle. Robert Haynes, president of the Mass AFL-CIO, warned lawmakers that basically you're either with us or against us. You're either on the side of collective bargaining, he said, or you are rewarding intractable, uncompromising management advocates. And he says that they'll keep that in mind in terms of endorsements of who supports what in this debate.
That's really par for the course for the AFL-CIO and the rest of organized labor in Massachusetts. Those letters, you know, basically come out of the printer at union headquarters practically on a weekly basis. So I think there are lawmakers who know whether they'll pay the price or not. And, you know, it's interesting to see DeLeo actually buck that challenge. The one thing I would add is that DeLeo described this bill or this legislation to us at the Herald, as he calls it, a jobs bill, as he points out to the unions, look, we're talking about a shrinking pot of money here.
Right.
And, you know, there are only so many dollars to go around. And if you're not enabling us to save some money, some serious money, that means more cops, more firefighters, more clerical workers, all union employees will lose their jobs.
Okay, there were a couple more stories we're going to try to get to today, but our time runs short and we don't want to shortchange our hubbub feature. That is those stories that sort of flew under the radar that may not have gotten the attention they deserve. I want to bring my co-host back in, Meghna, your hubbub for this week.
Well, today is Earth Day, even though the weather out there may not make it seem like we want to actually be outside celebrating the environment. But
cold Earth Day.
Yeah, exactly, a chilly one. But we dug up this article from Mother Jones about what kind of, it's the title's actually, what kind of booze is best for the planet? Because, you know, everything has its own carbon emissions. So just so that everyone knows, given that it's Friday afternoon, maybe we're thinking about that Friday afternoon cocktail. I just wanted.
Wait, can we guess? A smoky single malt scotch.
Oh, single grain. That has a lot to do with it, Jeff. But apparently, a U.S. Alcohol manufacturers release an annual equivalent of almost 2 million households worth of carbon emissions. But if you're a college frat boy, I tell you, good news, because kegs are the best. Are amongst the most environmentally friendly boozes out there, because alcohols out there, because they don't cost that much to ship and you can carry a lot in there. And also, Mother Jones wrote this, had a map of the United States, and they drew a diagonal from Ohio down to Louisiana. And if you live east of that diagonal, which would be us, and you really want a glass of wine, go European, because it costs less to ship from France. So some notes for maybe some afternoon weekend tipple.
Good.
On
some
Earth Day.
Some nice ideas there to stay warm on this day. Jeff, what do you have for us?
Well, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember the wedding of Prince Charles and Diana back in the early 80s might have labored under the assumption all these years that Americans really, really care about royal romances and weddings. So I was thrilled to see a poll that came out, commissioned by Vanity Fair and 60 Minutes, who knew that they teamed up to do anything, that found that only 4% of Americans are actually interested in next week's royal wedding between William and Kate Middleton. 66% say that they're not interested at all. And I will tell you, no politics intended. This is America. We are all supposed to be small R Republicans. We don't do kings and queens and dukes and princes.
So
and
you like this because we won the revolution and this is
exactly
the way it should be.
Exactly. Right, okay. 236 years ago, this week, Concord and Lexington, it was all about getting rid
Jeff,
of kings.
Jeff, apparently
and queens.
The Brits aren't that interested either. I heard that like 2 million Brits are leaving London.
They are finally wising up after all these years.
All right, finally, Julie,
you won't be surprised to know this isn't the first time I've disagreed with the Globe on a policy matter. I'm one of that 4%.
Julie.
I'm one of that 4%. I'm interested.
Thank God. Mix it up. Put him in his place.
You royalist, you.
No, I want to just mention that as recently as a couple of weeks ago, we wrote an editorial in the Herald that called for abolishing the Governor's Council, which we think is an antiquated body, and it's gone the way of the dodo and all that stuff. But, you know, I think we might have to reconsider, given the entertainment value that this body is now starting to produce. The State House News Service had a great story this week about a hearing on a clerk magistrate nominee that basically devolved into personal attacks. There were several no-shows. It's almost like the legislature of the old days. So, you know, maybe webcasting is the answer to, instead of a complete abolishing of the Governor's Council.
So first she's for the royal family, now she's for the Governor's Council. Oh, man.
That's true. It is a vestige of the monarchy. That's absolutely true.
All right. Very quickly, here's my hubbub. Yesterday, we reported on the new regional bike-sharing program that was announced with a lot of fanfare in Boston. Now, among those on hand, the local Boston burrito chain Boloco, which provided 200 free burritos for the assembled crowd. Boloco was praised by the city organizers for being so generous with their burritos. But then things got kind of unpleasant for Boloco. Later that evening, Boloco CEO John Pepper said on Twitter that because the city had failed to pull permits to serve food at their own event, a city inspector threatened to shut down Boloco's Federal Street location. Okay, now wait, I just want to read a couple of it. And by the way, I want to credit my colleague Adam Ragusa for spotting this. Here are some of John Pepper's tweets. How a city can thank businesses for supporting its civic efforts with rudeness, threats, and disrespect has us reeling today. Oh, dear. Our calls to City Hall about this were not returned. Julie Mahegan, Deputy Editor, Editorial Page Editor of the Boston Herald, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, this was fun.
And Jeff Jacoby, great to have you back.
Thanks a lot.
That's Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston.